This is the Taylor Report, CIT and 9.5 FM. There is an article in a Black Star News. Mumia's lawyers ask court to order life-saving hepatitis C cure. The lawyer in this instance is Brett Grote, and I believe Mr. Grote is with us now. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I'm here. Hi.
Hi, thanks very much. I know you're a busy man, and your client is in some considerable difficulty. And what are you asking to be done about his situation? We know he had a life-threatening moment not too long ago, and everyone was concerned. But I don't think we understood what his problems, medical problems were, and how his life can be saved.
Right. So let me unpack that by answering your first question. What we are seeking currently is that Mumia be provided with the cure for hepatitis C. Hepatitis C used to be a very hard-to-treat illness with low cure rates, and the treatments had very severe side effects that could cause a lot of other health problems. But advances in medication have revolutionized the way that the illness is treated, such that clinical trials have shown new medications curing 95% of those who are hepatitis C positive and without the side effects of the past medications. So at the end of July, we had confirmation that Mumia's hepatitis C is in fact active. He has what they call a viral load, and it is almost certain, we think to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, that the health problems that he's been having for the last year, beginning with the skin rash that's spread to affect more than 70, upwards of 80% of his skin, with severe inflammation and scaling and pruritus, or which is also just a term for severe itching. We believe that is a manifestation of his active hepatitis C. He's also been dealing with chronic problems that have been resistant to treatment, such as anemia. He's had new-onset diabetes, which could have been caused in part or in whole by the active hepatitis C, also in combination with the steroid injections he was getting in January and February in order to treat the skin condition, which in some instances can spike one's blood glucose level. So we are seeking that he be provided treatment for hepatitis C. Right now, it's our understanding that the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections is not providing anybody in their custody with hepatitis C treatments and not providing the old treatments, as they shouldn't be, because that's no longer the proper standard of care in the medical community. Mm-hmm. And the treatment that is the new consensus is not being provided, and they won't say why, but we believe that the issue is cost. Monopoly pricing on by the pharmaceutical industry here in the United States has the medication selling for $1,000 a pill. It's, an 8 to 12-week course. Treatments can cost up to $80,000 to $100,000 in order to cure the medication. The Pennsylvania Department of Corrections probably has conservative estimates. At least 10,000 people is holding in custody who are hepatitis C positive.
That's in Pennsylvania alone?
In Pennsylvania alone, there's more than 50,000 people in the prison. Conservative estimates from a class action lawsuit filed in Philadelphia in June over precisely this issue estimated upwards of 20% in the prison system have hepatitis C. And this type of disparity is common throughout the jails and prisons in the United States, which are disproportionately filled to the brim with people of color and poor people who are at greater risk for being hepatitis C positive. So we're seeking for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections to treat Mumia, to provide for his hepatitis C, to provide him with the proper standard of care, which are these medications that can cure the illness, and for them to do that immediately. We're going to be moving for a preliminary injunction very soon on this issue.
Yeah. What I'm hearing is, you could almost make an argument of a release on humanitarian grounds when you have somebody in his condition. Is that part of the argument as well?
I mean, it's part of our claims for relief, we do say if the Department of Corrections is unwilling, if defendants are unwilling or unable to treat his condition, he should be released from custody. Mm-hmm. But what we anticipate that prior to doing that, a United States court, a federal court, would order them to provide the treatment mm-hmm. prior to releasing him, right? But there are plenty of moral and political grounds that are persuasive for releasing Mumia from prison, who's been mm-hmm. there for more than 30 years after being framed up. But those who are sentenced to prison in the United States for any considerable period of time can expect to have, on estimate, up to 10 years of their life taken from them. Their mortality rates are that much higher because of the harms that are inflicted on those who are incarcerated under the quite brutal conditions that people face in the United States.
Yeah. Well, there's been an international campaign, of course, based on the frame-up in the original matter. I hope everyone is being alerted to this situation. It's because we're finding out that it's really just money separating life and death.
Yeah, we're certainly getting the word out there, and we appreciate you taking the interest in this story and helping us reach your audience, because like every injustice that has been perpetrated against Mumia, this is a lot bigger than just Mumia. I mean, mm-hmm. we broke that down earlier with how many people are being afflicted by this type of illness. But, health care in U.S. prisons was kind of reminds me of Gandhi's retort about his being questioned on the thoughts of, I think it was Western civilization, and he said it would be a good idea. You know, health care in U.S. prisons would be a good idea. What they have right now is a system of managed crisis where basic health care is withheld, where preventive care is not engaged in, where people are subjected to very unhealthy ways of living, from their diets to just the sociological and psychological conditions imposed on them. Yeah. And cost is not supposed to be a constitutionally permissible reason for denying care, but the medical staff just get around that by never admitting that it's really a matter of cost, mm-hmm. and they withhold treatments frequently until a crisis has emerged. I mean, I was on a visit with a client today, and we were hearing anecdotes about women in Pennsylvania prisons who had symptoms of serious illness ignored until it turns out they've had cancer, which has metastasized throughout their bodies. And these stories are just routine in the prisons.
So they take an interest when it's too late.
Yeah, and, then they'll send somebody to the hospital when they collapse, when it turns out the headaches they've been having for 2 years are actually a golf ball-sized stage 4 brain tumor, to give one example from, that we'd heard a while back from the State Correctional Institution, Fayette. And with Mumia's own case, you mentioned his near-death experience from earlier this year. On March 6th, he was given a blood test, which showed his glucose level was 419. And for those who know what a normal glucose level is, I mean, around 100, a little bit lower. If it starts getting into the mid-hundreds, you're having an issue with hyperglycemia. It's abnormal. 419 is dramatic and dangerously high. And not only did they fail to treat his hyperglycemia, they didn't even monitor it with any follow-up measuring of his glucose for more than 3 weeks, and they didn't even inform Mumia that he was hyperglycemic. This led to him losing consciousness, entering into diabetic shock, and suffering extreme, nearly fatal injuries.
Yes. That, by the way, that's another issue with him, right? He's strict. He's a prisoner of the prison doctors. He doesn't have his own doctors.
Right. We've been pushing for something as simple as to allow the medical doctors we are working with, and who are, his consulting physicians, and who see him as, and who, he is their patient, right? Mm-hmm. We've been seeking to have them be permitted to do an independent evaluation in a clinically appropriate setting, which just means they need some auditory privacy in a room with an examination table. The prison won't give that. There has been a doctor who's been able to see him just like any other regular visitor, but, having a you can't have a full physical examination in a prison visiting room with dozens and dozens of other people there, right?
Yeah.
So they don't allow second opinions, as they call them, because it is the prison's position in every instance that it is responsible for providing all the care that the person in their custody is due, and that they are always, of course, providing all that care. It's another way in which they view those that are in their custody as their property, and they are the gatekeepers, and they get to say who can see them and under what conditions. And if they want to deny somebody, even in the most inhumane of ways, access to see a doctor, right? A basic right taken for example, where it should be taken for, I mean, taken for granted by most who aren't incarcerated, is just routinely denied to people whenever they're, you know, in the custody of the DOC.
Yeah. Well, another form of using medicine in almost in a punitive way. Now, Mr. Grote, before we let you go, what stage are you in? What's going to happen next in terms
well,
of...
Well, we'd filed a complaint, a lawsuit in May that was actually dealing with some other issues. He was held at the hospital incommunicado. They wouldn't let lawyers or family talk to him. So we just amended that complaint to include the medical care claims. And so the next step is going to be filing for a preliminary injunction, and that is a motion that argues to the court that rather than wait for litigation to run its course, which is a protracted period, it is not swift by any means, we need an injunction, a court order now, in order to protect our client from suffering irreparable injury. So we will be, and we are working diligently to get that prepared, to get in front of court, and we're going to be arguing for the court to issue an order that they begin treating his hepatitis C immediately.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate it. Brett Grote, counsel for Mumia Jamal. I hope our listeners will call the U.S. Embassy and tell them about their concerns. And thank you again very, very much.
I hope so as well. Thanks so much for having me. Have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Brett Grote, and he represents Mumia Jamal on this matter. As I say, the world knows about Mumia. They should know now that this is a fight over hepatitis C. There is a cure, but it's in U.S. dollars, $96,000, they say. According to the articles I've read, in Egypt and in India, for $900, this medicine can be available. It's pills, and it's a 12-week course of pills. I understand they combine. There's two types, and they actually recommend they be combined. I think that's what brings the total up to $96,000. I did a little research on this. You'd be happy to know that if you live in Ontario, they don't help you with hepatitis C. That won't yet that not covered, and nor New Brunswick, nor Nova Scotia, nor British Columbia, nor Alberta. But guess what? There is a province in Canada that will provide this super medicine, the cure medicine, as part of your medical plan, and that is Quebec. You've heard about Quebec. They speak French in Quebec. Maybe that's what makes it work, the French connection. But it is a fact. And I know that Ontarians want to feel superior, but you're out of luck, and the Quebecers are not. You can check the Toronto Star. They wrote a long article about it. I'm surprised, Phil. Did you know this, that there is a cure?
Because no, I didn't know
this
it.
This is actually because...
But I am, I am
we have
aware
mutual friends who actually right. died of hepatitis C.
Yes, and I am aware of the issue of the drug companies are developing cures for diseases and then, of course, pricing them in such a way that nobody wants to pay for it.
They work on being monopolies harder than they work on providing medicine.
And by the way, the trade deals that Canada likes to sign and the one they're working on now reinforces the power of the monopolists and extends their monopolies. So, for instance, there are drugs now, and I can name a couple of them because of my people in my family use them, that should have been already now into the generic thing but are still charging extremely high prices because of Brian Mulroney's trade deal a generation ago where he added years to the monopoly protection.
These new trade agreements all carry the same luggage. They bring in
the
same
do.
problems.
You know, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way, having a national drug company, which would be not a national pharmacare program. We need that too. But a national drug company that would do research on behalf of the government, on behalf of the people of the country. We had that in Canada once, by the way. Insulin was the result of it, right? But we had such a plan once. Trudeau dismantled it. It wasn't Mulroney who dismantled it. Trudeau dismantled it, and he sold off the company to the private sector, who's still making a lot of money from it.
So maybe some of them are investing in the Justin's campaign.
If there's any justice for Justin, they would be because he's made them rich.
Yes, people have probably heard there is an election going on. I think somebody ought to put hepatitis C in this election, which brings me to say something about the U.S. election. I notice, and it's pertinent, Black Lives Matter has become a factor in American election in that they have appeared representatives at various rallies. There's good reports, bad reports. There's a lot of acrimony, but that's what goes with you should when you have racist police, when you have racist violence from a white supremacist state, then you, of course, need to fight back, and people have to be made uncomfortable. And Bernie Sanders was made uncomfortable, and so were a couple of other candidates. Hillary, I don't think Hillary has more of a, you might say, a military operation, and I don't think you can even stand up at the back of the hall. My guess is that the hauling part would be removing you from the room. Good for them. There's a fight, and people are putting this issue there and other issues. And we're having a campaign, and nobody – this doesn't happen. The candidates here are just sail along. They're not made to talk about the bombing of Gaza, or the policies, the unbalanced policy of the Canadian government towards that crisis area. Of Israel-Palestine. We don't have these candidates being made to say what they think on these subjects. It's very controlled, and we're told to watch television, turn it on, and then watch and then turn it off and then go back to whatever we told you to do in the first place. I think people ought to participate. I mean, I'm glad that Black Lives Matter, when they raised this subject with Bernie Sanders, they knocked a pretty big hole in his boat, and he had to repair that, and he has. I got to give him that. See, Bernie Sanders attempted to say, "Oh, I came here to give a speech about so and so. Don't distract me." That isn't going to work, because they have a problem. Black America's unarmed are being shot down. Something that happens also in Canada. So they must speak up, and so they want you to speak up. So Bernie then said, "Well, you know, I was a civil rights campaigner, okay, but as they used to say in Algeria, what have you done lately?" And so then he has bitten the bullet, and he's begun to speak and make this a part of the campaign. As a matter of fact, he's got a new press officer who is associated with the Black Lives Matter campaign, and they now put that's part of the rhetoric. Now, Bernie has decided to talk about this. Before he did, I had this distinct impression that this was going to be, again, white, liberal, social democratic politics, which somehow considers the issue of race not germane. There are people who try to hide race under talk about economics. Oh, we should all be equal. There should be more jobs. Yeah, but no. Starting with the police, but also jobs and housing and every other. You cannot name anything that doesn't involve discrimination against an identifiable group of people. And that has to stop. So Bernie Sanders has now begun to make that part of the campaign, which I think that's very helpful. And indeed, what he's doing, he's now we're getting a profile political, in my opinion, of him, is closer to the Rainbow Coalition of Jesse Jackson. But I would remind you where that ended up. It ended up being a little wagon pulled by the Clinton machine. And that was a disaster. So I would say to Bernie Sanders, thank you very much. That's all. But let's not kid ourselves. Either let's have a fight and win the nomination, or we have to continue the fight over Black Lives Matter and the class discrimination within America, which says the working class doesn't exist anymore. Now we have a middle class. I was taught that in the fourth grade. Come on, get off it. Actually, you have a working class, and a good portion of it doesn't have any work anymore. And you can't wall them off and build gated communities and get away with this, or you shouldn't be allowed to get away with it. Anyway, there's that. And again, by the way, August the 7th, you're listening to the Taylor Report. August the 17th at a different book list, 734 Bathurst.
746.
746.
Bathurst. It's next Bathurst. Monday, and that's at 7 to 9 p.m.
And what's the topic
is? Pan-Africanism Today, and we have two professors coming to talk about that.
That should be interesting.
It should be interesting.
There's a picture on that of the ad of Marcus Garvey. Last week we spoke to Ishmael Reed, and he spoke of the Nation of Islam, whose founder, Elijah Muhammad, happened to be a graduate of the Garvey movement. When I say graduate, he learned a lot as a Garveyite. And this Garvey's name doesn't come up enough. And the contribution he made to the struggle for equality. And on August the 21st, there's going to be a meeting, a talk. It's going to be Black Lives Matter, am I right?
That's right. Black Lives Matter, same address, 746 Bathurst Street, a different book list. And it's back. And it says, leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement will present an update on their current actions, their perspective on current issues, and plans for the future. And, of course, in Toronto, we have a major issue in Black Lives Matter, and that is the carding issue, which is used by the police to harass ordinary people as they go about their lives.
You know, there's nothing in the Bill of Rights or anybody's idea of human equality under the law that says some of the people can be carded. Why don't you just tell me that you believe in apartheid? Why don't you're just a white supremacist? Because we know that it's disproportionately applied to black Canadians. They have these words, carding. That's really, you're interrupting the movement of a citizen or of a person who's protected by the law. And if you don't have a reason to stop him, you can't. But they say, well, we're carding. Well, don't card. Rip up your little excuse and go forget it. It's discriminatory. It leads to the mindset leads to murdering people who are unarmed or just murdering them because they are seen to be vulnerable and have not the same rights. So it's a major fight. You're listening to the Taylor Report. We have a website, taylor-report.com, where previous programs can be heard. And, of course, you can follow us. We're on YouTube / the Taylor Report. I was speaking earlier of this news from today, and people who listen to our show know we follow the situation in Rwanda. And the BBC says Mr. Karaki, General Karaki, the spy chief, that's their word, has been released from in Britain. The case has been dismissed against him. The case was brought by Spain. And he had a lawyer of some note. Her name is Sherry Blair. She is the wife of the most wonderful imperialist anybody ever saw, the smiling, grinning, ghoulish Mr. Tony Blair, who, as some of the candidates for the leadership of the Labour Party say, Tony ought to be, we're going to look into him and about whether he committed war crimes and they're the ones that do it. But I'll point out that there has been talk in countries of the world that were bombed by the British under Mr. Blair and whose damage was done, like Iraq. And people have talked about, you know, he is regarded by many as war criminal because he lied to the British public about weapons of mass destruction. And many people said he outdid Bush because he was more photogenic and he was more cute with his language, and people enjoyed that. And so then it went ahead and blew that poor country into smithereens, murdering tens of thousands. I'll go with the low figure. Could he be extradited? Well, the British just said no, he couldn't extradite him. And his wife was arguing for Mr. Karaki, but yet her arguments would apply for her husband. So somebody should have said, well, maybe you have a conflict here. Are you arguing for Tony or are you arguing for Mr. Karaki? At the end of the day, I guess there's not a lot of difference. Tony, now that I think of it, Tony Blair is a special advisor to President of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. So you have a very interesting kind of collection of people. Again, it's the Taylor Report. The other thing I should mention, I said at the top we would say, is that in Burundi, the Supreme Court of Burundi, which had, through the Arusha courts, established itself with a country that has opposition parties. It was had many years of civil war. They have a president, Mr. Nkurunziza. He has been elected. By the way, he's also reputed to be quite popular, and I'm not surprised. But they've decided to target him. Now, next door is Mr. Kagame, who seized power by force and destroyed the Arusha Accords. He outlawed parties that he didn't like. Mr. Nkurunziza did not do that. Mr. Nkurunziza followed the law, had the election, he had opposition candidates, and he won. And he is exercising his authority according to the Supreme Court of his country. Nobody has any right to butt in there. No foreign state. There is no legal basis for Britain, France, or anybody else to get involved. That's none of their business. But now we have today being announced to the British press that there is an opposition leader, a former television personality, a Rwandan woman. And she, guess what, is in Kigali, where the General Kagame, the ruler since 1994, who has murdered his former friends, murdered him, and laughed about it. And he has a foreign minister who also laughed about it and mocked on Twitter the children of the victims. That state is now harboring a person who claims that she's leading an opposition to try to bring about the removal. Now, that will mean by violence of the government, the legal government of Burundi. And the collaborators, of course, are Tony Blair and the British government of Mr. Cameron, President Obama, and the President of France. And really importantly, the Belgians. They are playing a big role, and they played a big role in the destabilization of Rwanda, the murder of President Habyarimana, and the emplacement in power of Paul Kagame. So keep your eye on that, and don't be a sucker. People are, you know, and by the way, do not listen to Human Rights Watch. That's run by people out of the State Department. Out of the State Department. Human Rights Watch is nothing but a creature of the U.S. state, a creature, and it's a creepy creature, as far as I'm concerned. And Amnesty is the same pack of liars they've always been. People who rely on these guys, these are both funded out of London and Washington. There's nobody who works for human rights is funded, gets U.S. and British government money. And I know they have cute ways of hiding it, but it's there for anybody to see. If you want to be a sucker, of course, you can pretend you don't see it. But otherwise, wise up. So tomorrow, remember, 7 o'clock, the internationalactioncenter.org is going to have the – you can watch Ramsey Clark and others make the case, very important case about the Iran agreement and the potential war against Syria. So you're listening to Taylor Report. And Lucas, thanks very much. Phil Conlon, thank you very much. We'll see you next week.